Okay, Ezra. So we're going to do Ezra and Nehemiah. I'm not entirely sure how far we're going to get. We might not get to Nehemiah before we do a summer series, but we're certainly going to go through the whole thing. So Ezra and Nehemiah was originally one scroll, so it's actually one account. It covers the whole account of the exiles coming back to Israel, to Jerusalem. And Ezra is the last of the historical, or one of the last of the historical books. So in the books of the Bible have a different genre. You've got the Psalms and the poetry and the law, the Pentateuch. And these are the historical books, if we zoom in a bit. You see Joshua, Ruth, Samuel, Kings. These are the historical books that that outline the history of God's people, Israel, just a pure historical narrative. So this is where we are, coming to the end of Israel's life. So what's that look like on the plan of the Bible? Remember, we'll keep coming back to this. So we know where we are. Always ask, when we're reading the Bible, where are we? What time is it? And where are we? So as you can see, we're right here, right at the end, in terms of history of the Old Testament. So remember, God made a people, Adam and Eve. We had the fall. He made a promise to Abraham that out of his family would come a nation or a group of people that would bless the world, and one seed in particular. But that group of people, as it grew, became exiles or slaves in Egypt. And after this period of silence, they were freed. They were freed, they took the land, they began to develop as a nation with judges, then kings, and of course, as the history through Kings shows us, they went further and further away from God, further and further away from his ways, from living for him, and so God exiled them into Babylon. And this is where we pick up now, the return. They're coming out of this exile into return. So the period that we're looking at, the whole of Ezra and Nehemiah, covers just over 100 years there. So that's 539 to 430 BC. And at the end of that, that takes us into that big silence, that intertestamental period, the big silence. So that's where we are. This is the last part of history of God's people before Jesus came. Now, why were they taken away to Babylon? Well, the end of Kings tells us that. So 2 Kings, chapter 25, verse 8. On the seventh day of the fifth month, in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign over Babylon, Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, entered Jerusalem. Verse 9, he burnt down the house of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem, every significant building. So this was an event that the Jews, God's people, never thought was going to happen. No one would ever plunder the city and burn down God's house, but they did because they had gone so far from God's ways. And this is where they were taken. So this happened in three stages. So Israel, which was the northern kingdom, because the nation had divided, they were taken into Assyria, and the people from Judah were taken into Babylon. And this is where we're picking up events here. And the question to ask is then, why did God bring them back? He was so annoyed and angry with them, and righteously so. Why did he bring them back? Why start again? Well, again, remember, the Bible is about God's promises. And if God promises something, he will fulfill that. He will see that through. So we see in Genesis chapter 12, this is the promise to Abraham. Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3. God said, "And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and him that curses you I will curse. And in you," i.e. from one seed from your family, "all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So God said, "I am going to bless the world through you." And that's not going to happen if they're in exile. So he brings them back, and he promised that he was going to bring them back. Jeremiah 23, verse 3. "Then I myself will gather the remnant of the flock from all the lands to which I have banished them, and I will return them to their pasture, where they will be faithful and multiply." God promised before this happened that he would bring them back. A remnant will return, a remnant of Jacob to the mighty God. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 21. We'll talk about what exactly a remnant is. This is where we are. So God's people have been exiled, and God has brought them back to carry out his purposes, because he said he would. And so Ezra and Nehemiah is a story of three R's, really. The return, the rebuild, and the reform. And last one, inevitably, is the most important one. There's no point in God bringing back his people to live as God's people, to worship in his house, if they're not going to reform their ways. And this is the story of Nehemiah. This is where we're picking things up right from the start. The remnant return. So let's have a look how this works out. Of course, this always starts with God says. Always starts with God says. Not I say or I think or I feel. God says. God said, as we see in verse 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it into writing. So let's make this quite clear. This wasn't Cyrus saying, I've suddenly found God and I'm now going to be so nice that I'm going to let all the people that I've kept captive here return to their ways. Now, God has moved his heart and God said, I will preserve a remnant. There's more places in Jeremiah, he says that. Jeremiah 32, 36. Now, therefore, about this city of which you say it will be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon, that is Jerusalem, by sword and famine and plague, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Verse 37, I will surely gather my people from all the lands to which I have banished them in my furious anger and great wrath, and I will return them to this place and make them dwell in safety. So this is Jeremiah prophesying before this happened. Your whole life is going to be turned upside down. Everything you knew is going to be burnt down. But don't worry, I'm going to bring you back. They will be my people and I will be their God. Jeremiah 32, 38. God said, I will preserve a remnant. God said, I will preserve a remnant, and he will do that. He's going to do that. He said it many times, that I myself will gather the remnant, as we've looked at, Jeremiah 23, verse 3. A remnant. It's a bit of a strange word. It's not really a word that we use now. What is a remnant? Why is God so insistent on preserving a remnant? What exactly does that mean? What it doesn't mean is the dregs. Often we think of remnant as dregs. That would make us the dregs of society here. A remnant is not what's left at the bottom of the coffee cup or your fizzy drink. A remnant, rather, is what's left from what's been purified. So like gold, you purify gold, you put it into a furnace, you burn off all the impurities, you get rid of everything that you don't want. So all that's left is pure gold. That's what a remnant is. It's the bits, the only bits that you wanted to maintain or to fulfill a purpose. That is a remnant, and it's very important that we remember that. And God said, I will preserve a remnant, but it's got to be my way. And that remnant will be preserved through my ways and my grace. And we see throughout history, and we're seeing it right now, as I'll show you, that when society and nations or empires move away from God, the further they go from God, the greater the collapse and the calamity. The Greek Empire was astounding, huge cultural impact. But they went further and further and further from God's truth. That's what it used to look like. And that's what it looks like now. It's just rubble. The Roman Empire, at its heyday, ruled half the world. It was full of debauchery and all sorts of wicked ways. And that's what it looks like now. Rubble. When an empire drifts away from God, it will end in calamity. America's built on God's principles. The Constitution written on God's principles. A nation founded on God's principles. Now run by government officials who dress as women. And it is funny, But it's also dreadfully sad. This is who the president's picked to run the country. And this is what it looks like now. This is not Beirut. This is Baltimore. That's what happens to an empire when it drifts away from God. Calamity. God says, I will preserve you, but it's got to be my way. And he will assist them. Look at verse 6. Verse 6, all the neighbours. So as the exiles were leaving Babylon, all their neighbours assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts in addition to all the freewill offerings. What's that sound familiar to you? So remember, that they're leaving a place of captivity, and the people, their neighbours, are giving them gold and silver. What's that sound familiar with? Yes, absolutely. Exodus chapter 12, verse 36. The Lord had made the Egyptians, this is as they were leaving Egypt, had made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked for, so they plundered the Egyptians. That's what God's people are doing. That's what the remnant are doing here, essentially plundering the Babylonians, even though they've been held in them captive. And here they all are. Here's the millions of Hebrews leaving Egypt, going towards the promised land. Millions and millions of them. The count is over 1 million men, so we don't know how many other women and children are with that. We've just read there's, you know, thousands of donkeys here. There would have been hundreds of thousands of donkeys. But this is a remnant. Remember, this is a remnant. Look at verse 64 of chapter 2. Look how times have changed. Verse 64 of chapter 2. The whole company numbered 42,360. This is why it's a remnant. This is not the millions and millions we see here. It's just 43,000 people coming back. It's a far cry from what it was. And as we see as we go through Ezra, the buildings will be a far cry. But God says, I will preserve a remnant to carry out my purposes, fulfill my promises. And the people respond. Verse 5, chapter 1. The people responded, those whose hearts God had moved. Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. The people responded to God's initiative. God was the one initiating the response. And that's what we see in chapter 2 when we've missed out this list of people. What you see in all the people that God has moved, their hearts that's been moved, as you go through this list, you see it's very detailed in how it documents everything. And that's because God cares about every single one that belongs to him. He cares about families. He cares about the people that belong to him. And he documents it all. So we can see every single one God knew and had caused them to respond to God's grace. So what you see here, you see a commitment from the people. A commitment from the people. Have a look in that chapter 2, right down at verse 70. The priests, the Levites, the musicians, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants settled in their own towns, along with some of the other people, and the rest of the Israelites settled in their towns. Each one of these people, all this list of all these people, made a commitment to leave their current life and go out into rubble. So they've left the Persian Empire, which had its heyday, was an unbelievable place. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of those famous old wonders of the world. That's what they've left to come to this. They've left a life of luxury. Yes, you're under captivity, but I'm sure they can cope with that. They've got used to the culture. A life of luxury to rubble and hard work that awaits them. That's quite a commitment individually. Very important. And that was an individual commitment. Although they're coming back as families and groups, individually, they were making a commitment. But of course, they are coming back as a group and a body of people. So there's a collective element to this. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. If the individual wasn't headed towards a common goal, it wouldn't work. And we see that people individually contribute to a collective goal. Do you have a commitment and a contribution that both has an individual and a collective element to it? And again, you can see that from the list of people and the tribes that were coming back. Some of the Bibles will separate that list. And as you go through it, you'll see it. These are all the different functions of the temple. You've got your musicians, the gatekeepers, the priests. These are all functions of the temple. Although people individually are making a commitment to come back, the collective purpose is to have God's house of worship running again, a place where they can meet God, and that's a beacon for the rest of the world. This is a nation that lives under God's rule and wants to point you to God's rule. And that's literally what makes them God's people. That's why the decree, and that's why God's moved them, is to go back and build the house of the Lord first. We'll see the order in which they build things as they go back to Jerusalem, which is just a pile of rubble, is very important, very poignant. They start with the altar, then build the temple, and then they protect the city. Because it's the temple, it's worshipping God, is what makes them a people. That's what sets them apart. They come back as a people centered around the worship of God. Without that, they're just another group of people living amongst rubble. And they all individually contribute to this. Verse 68, chapter 2. When they arrived at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, some of the heads of the families gave free will offerings toward the rebuilding of the house of the God on its site. Verse 69, according to their ability, they gave to the treasury for this work 61,000 derricks of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priestly garments. All to make that work, individually contributing to the collective goal of getting them as a people and what makes them a people working again. Even though it was just rubble. But each one carries out their own part. Just like the parts of the body, it says each one gave according to their ability. Each one was different. Each offering was different. But it all collectively made one body. The heel can't do what the hair does. The eye can't do what the knee does. But it's still one body. Each individual part collectively contributing to the whole. God said, I will preserve a remnant. And he did, and the people responded individually and collectively. And what about us? Where do we fit into this? What does this mean for us now? Well, the beauty is, the fact that we're sitting here shows not only does that remnant is preserved and perseveres, we are that remnant. We're that refined gold that God is maintaining and keeping for his purposes, for his will and his honour. We're the ones that have been refined and processed. As a follower of Christ, you will always be a minority. We will always be on our own. It will always be a remnant. It will never be a dominant group of people. But God will preserve it for each generation. And the difference is that we're not building a temple for the Lord. The reason that makes us different as a remnant is that God builds it within us. Ephesians 2, verses 21 and 22. In him, in Christ, the whole building is joined together and rises to become a holy temple in the Lord. And in him, you too are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit. So as a remnant, we're not building with bricks and mortar. We're building with God's word and his Spirit. As a remnant, just like these are, he's called us together to point the world to who God is, to be a signpost to who God is. And that's why the church is made up of people, not bricks and buildings. The remnant that God preserves is just for people. He's doing the building work through us. So the question is, how do we respond? How do we respond? In exactly the same way. Exactly the same way, because we are that remnant. We are that remnant. We respond in exactly the same way. We are that purified gold that God will preserve. Let's try and work this out. Let's try and illustrate what a remnant would look like and how God works in us. What we're going to do is, we've got some lovely brown liquid here, but it's got full of huge lumps in. Do you want to come up here, guys? And what makes us different as a remnant of people going to Cyprus, what makes us different to these remnants is that God changes and refines us in a way different to the people then. As a group of people, God took out other people to create this remnant and refine them. What God does with us is he refines us from the inside. He takes out our old, mouldy, rotten heart and gives us a new one, just in the same way that we filter this liquid. So, Ames, you hold that over the bowl, and Lucy, you pour that in. We just want the liquid. We don't want all these lumps, these impurities. We just want the liquid. So pour that all in, chuck it all in. There we go. We don't want those impurities. No, all we're left with is not the dregs, but the remnant. This is the refined bit, the filtered bit. And that's what God has done with us. Thank you, guys. This is a totally different remnant, a totally different way of preserving a people. And that's why our response is eternal gratitude. We've been refined like pure gold to be pure gold forever. So our response is different to theirs. We have an internal, eternal gratitude to what God has done for us. And we do that individually and collectively here at Redeemer, both through commitment and contribution. Remember, we saw in verse 1 of chapter 1, God said he moved their hearts. He moved the hearts of the people. And in verse 70, in chapter 2, that we see that these people followed through on God moving their hearts. And they settled. They moved and settled to an area of rubble. And that's what's happened with each one of us, each one of you. God has moved your heart to worship him in Redeemer. Could have gone to a different church, could have given up altogether. But God has moved your heart to come to a new church, to build that up into a place that points other people to God. That's that individual commitment. And within that comes an individual contribution that forms the collective. As God moves our hearts, as we've just seen from the filtering process, he actually gives us new hearts to commit to him. And that's why we can say with joy, not out of duty, that this is my family, this is where I serve. No matter what happens, this is the group of people that I want to be with to worship God and to show the area who God is. And we want to turn that joy and commitment into collective contribution. We want to make that commitment funneled into the collective goal, the collective purposes of what God is doing. And that's where we ask ourselves, we say, what can I do? What skills can I bring? What things can I offer to make this collective goal work to glorify God? And there's really three simple ways in which we can do that. First one, the easiest one, and one we should all be doing, It's just praying for the life of the church, praying for each other and praying for the life of the church. All of us should be doing that, young and old alike, praying for God's church, praying that people will come and that he would be glorified in that. Praying that God will, as he did with the remnant back there, he resourced them and equipped them. We can just simply pray that God will continue to resource and equip this church. And then we want to think, well, how can I contribute? What can I give to the church to make it work as well? And we see that that's what the people did in verse 68 and 69, chapter 2. When they arrived at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, some of the heads of the families gave freewill offerings toward the rebuilding of the house of God on its site. According to their ability, they gave to the treasury for this work 61,000 derricks of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priestly garments. See, the giving here was not just financial, but they gave of other resources they had. Giving is time, your prayers, your efforts. It could be all sorts of things. And that's one of the things that we do brilliant here. But always remember, when we are giving, take joy from that, remembering that when we give, we're doing it collectively so that future generations will be preserved in the same way that God is preserving this remnant. And then lastly, what can I do? What can I do? How can I contribute individually to the goal? And again, that's something that works really well here. Everyone chips in. We saw that with the cafe church and the other functions that we've done. And we see that with the rotors, the serving of drinks, setting up, setting down. All of these things work well together because each one of us has made an individual commitment to a collective goal. But we should always be asking, is there anything else I can do? And one of the other things that we might want to start doing, and this is where it gets really hard, is maybe make new relationships. Are there new people that I can make a relationship with to invite them to church? And this is the key thing. Can I give back to the church by making new relationships and actually inviting people to church? Because that's ultimately how this church will be preserved through future generations. That's how the remnant will stay, is when the church grows organically like that. And this is difficult. This might be something that we find difficult. And we might think that we're not very good at it, but God always fills in the gaps. Just like he did with the Babylonians. They gave them articles of gold and silver as they let them go. God will fill in the gaps when we think we are short or under-resourced. Or we think we don't have the skills or the courage. If we prayerfully think about it and think, well, there's someone I might get to know who might want to come to church. As daunting as that sounds, God will equip us to do that because he said, I will preserve a remnant throughout all time. And that remnant will glorify me, no matter what generation that is. But the beauty is, we do it not out of duty, not out of response of being freed from a captivity of a foreign land, but we do it out of joy from the fact that we've been freed from the captivity of sin and death. Jesus has given us everything we need to serve him. Freed us from the captivity of sin and death. And so our commitment, as I said, is not out of duty, but it's in light of Jesus' commitment to us. Jesus said, I will preserve you to the end of time. So it doesn't matter if we fail. It doesn't matter if we're scared or we feel short. Jesus has made a commitment to us and he will follow that through to the end of time. Our motivation, therefore, is to draw other people into that remnant so they can look forward to seeing Jesus at the end of time too. Let me pray.